This is 1330 WRCA Watertown, Boston.
Hello, good evening, and welcome to Tube Talk, the program that celebrates old radio sets, old music, and maybe even old people. We are dedicated to the preservation of radio. And how about a little cup of coffee to get things started?
Way down among Brazilians, coffee beans grow by the billions, so they've got to find those extra cups to fill. They got an awful lot of coffee in Brazil. You can't get cherry soda, 'cause they've got to sell their quota, and the way things are, I guess they never will. They've got a zillion tons of coffee in Brazil. No tea or tomato juice, you'll see. No potato juice, 'cause the planters down in Santa's all say no, no, no. A politician's daughter was accused of drinking water and was fined a great big $50 bill. They got an awful lot of coffee in Brazil. Eggs need savor. Coffee ketchup gives them flavor. Coffee pickles way outsell the dill. Why they put coffee in the coffee in Brazil. No tea, or tomato juice, you'll see. No potato juice, 'cause the planters down in Santa's all say no, no, no. So you'll add to the local color, serving coffee with a cruller. Dunking doesn't take a lot of skill. They got an awful lot of coffee in Brazil. Man, they got a gang of coffee in Brazil.
Hey, Pedro, get the flashlight. I cannot find the sugar.
As if he really needs an introduction, Frank Sinatra. Now, this fellow may need an introduction. This is actually off of a record album. Wow, a record album. A piece of plastic we spin on a table. So it does have a rather authentic sound to it. I apologize if it's non-digital, but being non-digital sometimes is really what it's all about. And this is Tiptoe Through the Tulips. 1930 recording, Nick Lucas from the Gold Diggers of Broadway. It actually was recorded in 1929. A very unique period piece, but something you would probably hear on that old Philco.
Say we keep the showers. through the tulips with me.
Just remember, Decca simulated stereo records can be safely played on today's monaural phonographs to the maximum sound capabilities of your equipment, yet will reveal full stereo listening quality when played on your stereo phonograph.
I'm in the mood for love. Simply because you're near me. Funny, but when you're near me, I'm in the mood for love. Heaven is in your eyes, bright as the stars we're on. To think of whether this little dream might fade. We put our hearts together. Now we are one. I'm not afraid if there's a cloud above. If it should rain, we'll let it, but for tonight, forget it. I'm in the mood for cloud above. If it should rain, we'll let it. But for tonight, forget it. I'm in the mood for love. I'm
in the Mood for Love, 1936, sung by Francis Langford from Every Night at Eight, with orchestra directed by Harry Sosnick, certainly a name that no one in the world remembers.
Jay Bing. Hi, Dick. You remember Lullaby of Broadway from Gold Diggers of 1935?
Well, I remember the tune, but I can't remember 1935 very well.
Who wants to?
I think it goes something like this, Dick. Check me if I'm wrong.
Come on along and listen to the lullaby of Broadway. The hip-a-ray, the ballyhoo, the lullaby of Broadway. the rumble of a subway train, the rattle of the taxi, the daffodils who entertain at Angelo's Maxi. When a Broadway baby says goodnight, it's early in the morning. Manhattan babies don't sleep tight until the dawn. Good night, baby. Good night, milkman's on his way. Sleep tight.
Let's call it a day. Listen to the lullaby of old Broadway.
That was Dick Powell with Bing Crosby from the Bing Crosby radio program. You're listening to Tube Talk on WRCA Radio, 1330 AM, the Antique Radio Collectors Program. Well, we recently had a storm, a hurricane, up here in the Northeast. We broadcast from Boston. And a funny thing happened during the recent storm. Radio came through. Free radio. AM radio. The kind of radio you can listen to on an antique set, or if your power is out, a nice battery, battery-powered radio. And in the wake of the big storm, when the internet providers and utility companies and cell phone towers went down during the storm, found out, was reminded of just how relevant radio can still be. We have a big 50,000-watt station up here. Gets out to 38 states overnight. They stopped their regular programming, called in their talk program hosts, and did storm radio. Radio updates, weather updates, news updates, call-in from callers. Callers who phoned in from up and down the eastern seaboard. Folks who had already experienced the storm, told folks, shared their stories, what's coming up, what's heading towards New York, Connecticut, Boston. Real time, real news from real people telling us what to expect. There were news and weather updates, local news, national news, reporters, news from the listeners. A little neighborhood on the air sprang up. And it was really a good place to hang out during the storm. Radio will work as long as there's power to broadcast and someone with a receiver. You don't need to register, you don't need to log on, you don't need to play with the mouse or the screen to change pages. Radio does it all for you. All of this information, entertainment, human drama, cascading out, all put together for you to listen to. People have been communicating verbally for a lot longer than they've been writing and communicating with written words. It's good to hear the voice of a fellow human being, reassuring and comforting. It may even be a better way of connecting. It is the essence of good radio. WLW in Cincinnati experimented with high-power radio in 1934 under the call sign W8XO with a 500-kilowatt signal. They received approval to broadcast at that strength with on their regular station, and WLW began broadcasting at the new strength. President Roosevelt apparently actually pressed a ceremonial red button to launch the new signal. Well, as you can imagine, a station that could communicate with that many people at that level of power caused a few complaints. Apparently, there were some complaints that the power was being interrupted to surrounding homes and businesses because they'd pull so much juice to run that signal. People were complaining about that. Also, other broadcasters were complaining in that they were being drowned out, interfered with as far away as Toronto. Stations were complaining, it's not fair, we can't get through clearly, we're losing audience. Many complaints. So many so that eventually the signal had to be reduced. And Congress actually introduced an act and passed an act called the Wheeler Act, the Wheeler Resolution, that limited broadcasters to 50,000 watts, which we now consider high power, clear channel, you know, the flamethrower. Well, you can only imagine what 500 kilowatts would reach. It must have been pretty intense. And interestingly enough, the government, for emergencies, and obviously at that point in time, you know, getting to the World War II trouble in the country's history, W8XO kept an experimental license and would be authorized to go up to 500 kilowatts power again for broadcasting. They actually held that experimental license through the end of December in 1942, with the government having the intention that if they ever needed to reach a mass audience, they could broadcast from one tower, from one station, and reach probably half the country, if not maybe the whole country at that time. And another testimony to the power of good radio. I'm going to have just a little more music here, and then we're going to go on to our guest for this evening's show. By the way, we have an email address set up for the show. Let us know what you think. Drop us a line. Send us your comments. TubeTalk1 at gmail.com. TubeTalk, the number one, at gmail.com.
Riding on the city of New Orleans, Illinois Central, Monday morning rail. 15 cars and 15 restless riders, 3 conductors and 25 sacks on mail. All along the southbound Odyssey, the train pulls out at Kankakee and rolls along past houses, farms, and fields. Passing trains that have no name, and graveyards full of old black men, and the graveyards of the rusted automobiles. Songs again, the passengers will please refrain. disappearing railroad blues. Good morning, America, how are you? Say, don't you know me? I'm your native son. I'm the train they call the city of New Orleans. I'll be gone 500 miles when the day is done.
Well, our friend Willie certainly recorded that song after the golden age of radio. I've always liked that song, and I think that radio is much like that railroad song that certainly evokes a different era, a little nostalgia. I think radios and railroads have a lot in common these days. Welcome back to Tube Talk on WRCA 1330 AM. We're joined this evening by Lou McGrish, a collector and purveyor of fine radios. Lou can be found at the Radio Attic under the Exceptional Radio Bin. Just look for Lou McGrish Radio Attic on Google, and it'll come right up. Lou sells some of the finest radios I've seen, a lot from the 30s, which a lot of people say is the real high point of the radio era, usually all woods. And from what I'd have to say, a lot of some of the finest examples from some of the different manufacturers of the time. Some really nice stuff, and it's very educating to look at your site too, Lou, because you tell a little story about a lot of the different manufacturers and a little bit of a story about the radio as well. So I learn a lot. Even, you know, I don't buy anything, but I do learn a lot from your site, and they're real pretty to look at. How did you really get started with the Radio Attic and the selling of radios? From what you were telling me yesterday when we were talking, it's sort of a second career for you, huh?
Exactly. I was forced into premature retirement when the industry that I had worked within for 35 or so years moved to China, and I was back and forth working for the Chinese for a year, and I absolutely hated it, and I needed something to do, and I really had always enjoyed my radio collecting and as a hobby, and it gave me a purpose and a element to keep engaged fully with something. So the hobby became a retirement business.
Well, that's pretty cool. And how would you rate business now? I guess you were telling me when you first started out, you know, selling was fast and furious, but, you know, with the economy we have now and just the overall situation with people and their, you know, having a little extra cash, how's things going for you lately? How are sales?
Actually, in spite of the news on the TV, it's actually been measurably better than I would have thought. But overall, in the 4.5 years that I've been doing this, it certainly is much slower than it had been, whereas I'm finding that I'm selling more and more to the obsessive collector type as I once was, you know, obsessed with finding the best, the rarest, and so forth. And I found that generally the people that had just a latent interest in it, or an interior designer looking for an embellishment in an office scenario or in a residential scenario, I haven't seen as much of the what I construe as the consumer business as I had several years ago.
Now, you know, something that is kind of interesting, you have a relationship with a fellow who's a real technical pro, from what you were telling me. And one of the things I noticed on your site is you have an option for folks. They can ask for a jack, an RCA jack, I'm imagining, to be included, to be, you know, for the radio to be retrofitted with one. So, you know, even if somebody lives in an area where they may not pick up a lot of stations on AM, they have the option of either playing tape or CD or, you know, some type of an auxiliary source or an iPod they could plug in and play it through a vintage set. Does that seem to be something people are liking?
Actually, when I first started it, it was very slow in its onset. But increasingly people are taking it as an additional option. We're located out here in Asheville, North Carolina, and the offerings, as far as selection of material content on AM radio is relatively limited. And because of us being situated in the mountains, AM radio doesn't travel very far in a mountainous area. And so both the technician, who's a 67-year-old retired person who'd spent their whole life in the business of restoring and repairing electronics, and I got together and we, you know, lamented the fact that there was nothing for us to listen to. So this conversion works extraordinarily well. It really is only applicable to sets that were manufactured 1933 and later. But if you have a MP3 or a digital player that offers you FM, it gives you all of the FM selection, which is a more current content. Or if you want to listen to Frank Sinatra or Ella Fitzgerald, whatever content you want to listen to, you can.
Yeah, that's always been something that, you know, when I hunt around for radios, if I have a choice, you know, if I'm at a meet or if I'm checking something out and thinking of buying it, you know, when I found out that these things actually had, wow, it has an RCA jack. Well, you know, it just expands, you know, immensely what you can listen to. And it's kind of a kick sometimes to play more modern music, especially through an old set. And I have a Carlson Stromberg Carlson that my sister found at the end of a guy's driveway. And you know, it was a really nice set. It needed a lot of work to get back to where it was, but it's got a really nice speaker in it. And fortunately, it has the RCA jack in it. So I listen to FM, I listen to my CDs on it, and it's always sort of a, makes it a little more of a conversation piece than it already is. So it's a real nice option to have, and I guess I'm fortunate
that
up here.
That was an option that was added specifically for phonographs years ago.
Yeah, because I guess the phonograph wasn't the best speaker, so you plug it into your radio.
Exactly. And you know, it really, and it, like the mini jack that we're adding, which is just the next technology, those RCA jacks on the back of the sets work very well.
Now, you know, something else I've also noticed about a lot of the stuff on your site, a lot of the sets, most of them seem to have original finishes. So when you're hunting for radios, are you really trying to avoid things that are that have been refinished or reworked already? You prefer to get it in sort of the virgin state, hopefully well-preserved. Is that something you do by, you're really trying to do it intentionally, or is it something that just seems to work out that way?
Absolutely, it is intentional, whereas the collectors, the more advanced collector is resolute in trying to find the finest original example of a given set that they possibly can. And so intentionally I try to hand select all of what I buy and call through a great deal of material to find those outstanding sets.
Yeah,
exceptional ones.
You know, the other thing that people like to find too, especially, I personally do not do technical restoration work, but from the folks that I've brought sets to have worked on, I mean, it's great if it has the original finish and it looks good. It's even better for the technician, and probably your technician would have a similar opinion. You'd like to find something that wasn't really worked on too much. Hopefully, you know, something that just, when it stopped working, somebody put it in a closet or an attic or down the basement and left it alone, and wasn't something that somebody decided to use for a science fair project. You know, if something's been an attempted restoration several times over on an old set, is just really can be a disaster for the technical restorer who wants to go in there, because he's going to try to undo all these other sins, all these other foul-ups. Whereas if you have something that's pretty much as it was when it left the factory, though it might have some components that failed or tubes that failed, at least when you go and you look at the schematic or you go and you look at the technical drawings, it's pretty much the way it was, and it makes it for a lot easier restoration. Do you try to find things that weren't really worked on either? Is that another part of your hunting technique?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, two things came to mind is in your statements. First of all, the hobbyists are the worst, because they don't know anything of what they're doing, and a lot of times it's learning on the job, so to speak. But additionally with that, I mean, radio and television repair was a relatively unregulated, unlicensed expertise years ago. Anybody who had a soldering gun and few meters and so forth could represent themselves as a radio TV repair shop. Some of the guys were very smart, very, very good in what they did, and there were a lot of people that really shouldn't have been in the business, but there was no qualification to call yourself a radio TV repairman. The less that's been done, the better. I listen to my tech all the time talk about how somebody's cut this, that, and the next thing out, and even though he has the diagram in front of him, it's like a Rubik's Cube to put back together what somebody destroyed. But a lot of the work that's done on the radios is done underneath the chassis, and time and place when you're acquiring the sets, you can't really disassemble them to really gain the full scope. You can look in the back, see if the speaker is the right speaker, if it's been replaced, you know, and so forth. But until you actually disassemble and bench the chassis, the element is, what am I going to find out? What am I going to see?
Right, right. It's hard. It's hard to tell. You know, and it's funny, too, some things that I've wanted, because that's a particular set I've always, you know, I've wanted that to fill a hole in my collection, or that's something I've been looking for. You know, sometimes you'll go where you shouldn't, and you look at it, and you say, well, you know, I'll take a chance on it. And sometimes it's really worked out, and it's been lousy for me, and that the thing is just cobbled up and all hacked up, and it's a beast, you know, something you just want to say, you know, I don't even, maybe we just polish it up and we'll look at it. But I've been extraordinarily lucky a couple of times. I found in a small shop near where my son goes to school, I've been by this little junk antique shop 100 times. I never went in. One day I go in, and there's a Philco 45L, I guess from about 1935, 1934, sitting there. I didn't even notice it. It was all covered up with doilies and cups and plates. And so I went over, and we tried to look at it, and I asked the woman, I said, where'd you find this? And, you know, see if I could find out a little intelligence on it before I decided to make her an offer on it. And she goes, well, she goes, I have it on consignment for an older couple. A gentleman in his 90s told me it had been sitting in his living room for 65 years. Okay, this sounds good. Well, as it turns out, we pull the thing, we'll pull the chassis out of it. I mean, one tube had been replaced. I think the chassis was almost exactly the same as when it came out of the factory. So that's like the best case scenario I think I've ever had. And on the other case scenario is I've had these things that have just been so hacked up, I'll bring it to the guy to have him take a look at restoring it. And I just, you know, you get one of the dirty looks. It's
he looks at you and says, mister, you don't have enough money.
I know. Back to the
draw. You know, really, when you look at things, I mean, I've seen sets that have been absolutely, from the outside, an absolute nightmare, and I bring it up on a Variac, gently, of course, and find that the radio plays great, and then on the other side of the coin, you see a beautiful cabinet, it looks pristine, and you bring it in, and Mickey Mouse and Minnie Mouse have lived in it for a few years and eaten every wire, and all the coils have been degraded by what Minnie and Mickey do, and as a consequence, you know, it's virtually an unrestorable set. But I wanted to point out that in the late 20s, when AC came in, and most there were table sets, but the big thing was to own a console, because it was the focal point of your life, because listening to radio was everything, and as shortwave evolved, that even brought a greater dimension to things. There were no TVs. Yeah, you had a crank-up phonograph, but it was really the focal point. And the radios were expensive. I mean, I see so much literature where in 1928 you bought your 8-tube RCA console for $218 plus tubes.
Well, that was a lot of money for that day.
Yeah, and all the way into the 30s, of course, as the Depression wore on, you know, the price of the radios became more and more of a competition, an element for the availability of being able to afford one. But the price, people spent really big money, and the elderly people, the depression people, took care of their things.
Yeah, well, it was the type of thing, too, once they had it, and it, especially after you got a little hooked on it, you know, you really wanted to take care of it well, you wanted to get it repaired well. And, you know, as you were speaking to the point, you know, relatively speaking, doesn't sound like a lot of money today, but by those standards, in that type of an economic catastrophe, that was a heck of a lot of money. And look at some of the stuff that Zenith did with some of their high-end sets. I mean, they were making stratospheres, and you know, people barely, you know, were lining up in soup lines all over the country, but there was still a clientele that could afford it, and it was an amazing amount of technology and beautiful cabinetry work, too. You look in some of these...
you look at the McMurdo Silvers and the Scotts of that era that sold to the very gilt-edge customers. In fact, McMurdo Silver would put an engraved plaque on the back of their radios that this radio was literally made for so-and-so. And McMurdo Silver was superseded by Scott. And those radios sold for $2,000 to $3,000 a piece in 1932 and 1933.
Well, I guess there's always somebody who has a couple of bucks in their pocket, but... You know, that probably makes them a little rare. I don't think they sold. Well, you'd probably be surprised how many they sold. I was going to ask you, you know, you're talking a little bit about some of the manufacturers there. Do you have any favorites? I mean, do you find that anything on your site, in your antique barn, so to speak, there sells better than the others? I mean, Zenith, Philco, RCA are sort of the big national names that always come up. But do you find that people seem to go after more of one brand than another?
Well, I think, the dedicated collectors, I mean, the Zenith collectors are probably the most, you know, prominent group to my mind. And, you know, Zenith made some very nice radios from 1935 on through 1938. Interestingly, I find that certain manufacturers made certain types of radios better than others. Zenith for Tombstone radios, in the timeline that they were made, were probably the best ones made. Earlier 30s, the Philco and Atwater Kent cathedrals were better sets. Interestingly, Philco made a fair number of tombstones. Atwater Kent made just a few of them. And Zenith made virtually no cathedral radios. So it really varies in my mind between the type of radio that you're looking for and who the best manufacturer is, but probably the Zenith collectors are the most dedicated lot.
And I think that big black dial look and a lot of the cabinetry was really so nice, and it's a real draw, and it's still something that lights up the room nicely now. And it's funny, I never really thought of this too much, but I was reading this book about Zenith, and they had mentioned that, much like they have in movies now with different products, that, you know, you have product placement, you know, a manufacturer will pay somebody who's making a movie to use their products in the background or whatnot. I guess Columbia Pictures had a deal with Zenith, and Zenith was sort of a leader in having their products placed in front of the public. You know, the movies were immensely popular in the 30s, and I notice it now because, you know, whether it's a good thing or a bad thing, I don't know. I kind of like the Three Stooges, but I like the nostalgia of it as well. But a lot of times when there's a radio on the in the skit that they're doing, I'll try to zoom in on it a little bit, and Zenith is there, and, you know, you see people that you were talking about it being the focal piece of your room. The radio was decorated. It has a doily. It might have a nice vase with some flowers. You know, they really look so nice, but Zenith does seem to have a very loyal clientele. I'm a little partial. I like a lot of RCA stuff, but I know some of the RCA stuff is manufactured. It can be very difficult to work on, and, again, sometimes I get frowns when I bring that stuff in to be worked on.
Part of RCA, General Electric, and Westinghouse, especially during the Armstrong patent brouhaha, where RCA, owning the Armstrong patents, tried to control the world, they made these capacitor packs that are very hard to replace, and inevitably one or more of those capacitors go bad, and it's quite, they're a little more challenged, but it was the Henry Ford methodology of assembly and combining various components into a single module.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And it was great from a production standpoint at the time. It probably saved money, which allowed them to offer their sets for less at retail. But after the fact, 70 years later, they're murder to work on.
Yeah, yeah. It's, you know, you were mentioning you were interested in radio prior to becoming involved in the selling ends of things. How did you, have you always had a liking for, was it, you know, the media, or was it just old radios in general? Did you have a set when you were a kid, or did you pick something up that you were really fond of that kind of started your interest in antique radio?
Well, when I was growing up, two things. First of all, television was an 8-screen, pie-screen, black-and-white set with rabbit ears, maybe further embellished with some aluminum foil. So television was, you know, not, shall I say, as robust. I mean, when I look and see what, you know, the flat screens look like
sure.
today compared to a 50s TV. The second thing was that I was always a bad boy. I was always getting sent to my room. And so really my interest in radio started as a consequence of constantly getting disciplined, being sent to my room, and I had any number of those little germanium crystal radios that you would buy at the, you know, Ben Franklin variety store.
Yep.
And I would clip it to the screen and then, or maybe clip it to the radiator that heated the room in the wintertime. And I was living, I grew up in Cincinnati, so in addition to WLW, I could listen to WLS and WHO, and depending upon atmospheric conditions, listen everywhere. And that's what really hooked me onto radio, was toy germanium crystal radios.
It's funny you mentioned WLW, because I can even pick up WLW, especially in the winter, at night, overnights, up in Boston. And they have a great program. You know, there's so many syndicated programs on now that it's just, it's the same in every city. But they have a program on. It's a overnight program geared towards the long-distance trucker and hauler. And just the guys who call in are just such characters, and they use their handles. And it's just, it's so different from what, you know, a lot of the overnight radio. It's just syndicated stuff. It's the same in every city. And it's a kick, and it kind of makes you think back to the days when somebody, you know, probably was listening to a lot of radio programming from a great distance, and some of those sets could really pull it in too. Some of the, especially the Atwater Kents,
well,
and the early Zeniths and Philcos.
Those were the clear channel stations, Paul. And you know, the WLW is a 50,000-watt broadcaster. In fact, I remember how years ago between Cincinnati and Dayton was the old. What was that, Voice of America, one of the broadcasting for Voice of America, and they said that you could listen to WLW just off of the antennas for the Voice of America towers just south of Dayton. And so the strength of the signal of WLW or any of the clear channel stations, and that was the purpose of clear channel, is second to none. But WLW, interestingly, was owned by the Crosley family.
Yep, Pal Crosley, yeah. I was mentioning that a little earlier in the show. I talked a little bit about how much radio kind of came back into play a little bit. We had a hurricane up this way, and it's funny because when all else fails, the computers, the cell phones, the internet connections, you know, if you've got a battery-powered radio, you can still pick up news, weather, you can still find out, you know, a lot of these call-in programs, you could still find out what's going on. And I was doing a little research on some of the big power stations, and I guess for a while, back in like 1934, WLW had an experimental license, and they were going at 500,000 watts. So you could pick that up probably on your fillings as well as on your radio set.
I had people doing that, but I guess I just never had the right dentist.
That would save some money on radios. Anything in your own collection that you maintain now? How would you characterize yourself? Are you a Philco guy or a Zenith guy, or do you just like what's visually appealing?
I'm pretty much of an eclectic collector. I have sets in my collection just because I like them. I do have some cathedrals. I have some tombstones. I wouldn't say that there's any particular brand that I like. I think Stuart Warner made some interesting looking sets and some of those that had a lot of really deco styling to it. I also am enamored to Stromberg Carlson for the quality of what they made and the engineering contained within. Stromberg Carlson was a scientific and telephone maker in the late 1800s, early 1900s, and the engineers had more sway at that factory than virtually anywhere else. And so when you get into the radios, they're very well engineered. You know, I have a few Catalans, a few cathedrals, a little bit of everything.
Yeah, it's funny when you mentioned Stromberg. They were up, you know, up this way. They're up in Rochester, New York. And I had a pal in the office who, when he bought his house, it had this huge console radio sitting in the garage. And the people who sold it to him said, well, we're going to get rid of it and we'll clean the rest of it out. He said, well, you know, why don't you leave that there? That looks kind of interesting. And I guess he had an uncle who was fancied himself as a radio repair guy. I think he did was in the service. He had had some exposure to working on radio, and he actually got the thing running for this guy. And you know, so then he's cleaning out his garage again, you know, and he said, well, I'm gonna just dump this thing. So I said, well, no, I said, let me take a look at it at least. So I go over, and the cabinet was in pretty good shape, and you know, the chassis looked really good. So I've got it at this stage down in the basement. But when you look at it, and you look underneath it, and you look at the gauge of the metal on the chassis, and you know, they're really put together like just battleships. And so someday we get enough dollars, we're going to try to restore that one. But they're real keepers, and that I think is one of the other things that people will say on that period, that 1930s era. You know, they're made to be restored almost. When you get into the post-war stuff in the 40s and in the 50s, well, you still have some interesting sets and still some pretty good ones. You know, the quality just wasn't there as far as something worthy to be restored again. And maybe that's a reason why those sets from the 30s are what, you know, people refer to as the iconic sets. Those are the ones that people really want to go for. And I think that's another reason I like your site so much, is that sort of focus on that particular time frame.
Right. Well, I kind of let my customers direct me to what they're looking to buy. You know, the only sad side to your statement is that when I look at radios total sub, I mean, today console radios are selling for a fraction of what they once did. And yet and still, some of the cabinetry of them was extraordinary. And I get calls from people. Unfortunately, I don't sell console radios because of the shipability
right.
of them. I mean,
size.
The cost of shipping is astronomical. If you adequately pack things for the mechanical sorters that represent distribution today, whether it's post office or UPS or FedEx, and they're brutal, but consoles are virtually impossible to ship. And some of them were just remarkable radios. The workmanship was just second to none. And but there's not a great demand for them unless there's something special, a Zenith case in point, or
Scott.
You know, a Scott McMurdo, you know, iTube count.
And I guess the other problem that you run into with that, too, from the collector's point of view, as much as people might like to get them, because a lot of times they're good bargains, you'll see them and they're offered at very reasonable prices, it's because nobody has room for all these things. You know, it's easier to be a tabletop guy than it is to do the console scene.
You know, the same thing thwarted, I think, antique television collecting. They take a lot of space. They're also very hard to maintain. Vis-a-vis antique radios.
I'd just like to say thanks a lot for being on tonight. I appreciate your time, and I'll be back in touch with you. Hopefully we can have you again on the Attic. Anybody who'd like to check out exceptional radios that Lou McGrish offers is more than welcome to check out the Radio Attic. Look for Lou's little subsection in the Attic, and at the very least, it's an education, and he has some real pretty things to look at. Lou, thanks an awful lot for being on tonight.
The object of my affection can change my complexion from white to rosy red. Or anytime she holds my hand and tells me that she's mine. There are many girls who can thrill me, and some who can fill me with dreams of happiness. But I know I'll never rest until she says she's mine. Now I'm not afraid that she'll leave me, 'cause she's not the kind who'll be unfair. But instead I trust her implicitly. She can go where she wants to go, do what she wants to do, I don't care. The object of my affection can change my complexion from white to rosy red. Oh, anytime she holds my hand and tells me that she's mine. The object of my affection can change my complexion from white to rosy red. Oh, anytime she holds my hand and tells me that she's mine. Now there are many girls who can thrill me, and some who can fill me with dreams of happiness. Oh, but I know I'll never rest until she says she's mine. Baby, I'm not afraid that she'll leave me, 'cause she's not the kind who'll be unfair. But instead I trust her implicitly. She can go where she wants to go, do what she wants to do, I sure don't care. The object of my affection can change my complexion from white to a rosy red. Oh, anytime that baby holds my hand and tells me that she's mine.
The Object of My Affection, 1940 recording by Pinky Tomlin. The High and the Mighty, 1954, nominated for an Academy Award for Best Song, a Dmitri Tiomkin and Ned Washington composition.
I need no signs, I need no chart. The Weather Bureau in my heart is saying it's raining sunbeams. The world is young, it's spring again, and I can laugh and sing again, for I know it's raining sunbeams. Now that there's a rainbow-colored sky on display, each gray yesterday seems so far away. Those golden darts from paradise are pouring down to break the ice. Go right off home, make it known to everyone you love. It's raining sunny sunbeams from above.
Thanks for listening to Tube Talk on WRCA 1330 AM. Email us at tubetalk1@gmail.com. Good night now.